Donald, why won't they help you?
No one is coming.
They're leaving you out in the cold.
You have no one.
Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis say they're out of the race.
They dragged you publicly.
But they keep winning votes in the primaries.
Without even trying.
Votes you wanted. Votes you deserve.
You built this movement.
Their voters just don't like you.
Are they embarrassed by you?
More than 20% say anybody but Donald.
Sounds like your dad.
Does it hurt your feelings?
Of course it does.
But tick, tick, tick.
Shouldn't you stop them?
As the disgrace, twice impeached, four times indicted ex-president.
Of course you should.
They're counting on you being too weak.
You are.
Too tired.
You are.
Too old.
The sun is setting.
The old Trump would have punished them.
Where is Teflon Don?
But that's not you anymore, is it?
It's all coming to an end.
Oh, man. Those Republicans at the Lincoln Project are pretty mean, aren't they?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Yes, they are.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
And I like it.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs.
Democrats could learn a lesson.
Clowns to the left of me. Jokers to the right, here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am from Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles. This is the broadcast that's heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADRM, Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet. So the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. Glad to have you here with us. We got a lot to get to today for a change. Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hi. There's some stuff going on.
Some stuff, including, by the way, your latest Green News report. That's coming up a bit later, whether you like it or not. Whether anyway. Hey,
it's fun. You'll like it.
We'll see. We'll see. Anyway, we got to start with a correction. As you know, we don't make many errors in our coverage, I would like to think. But when we do, we like to try to put the correction right up front, if possible, as opposed to burying it at the end of the show, as many outlets do, etc. So I don't know if I actually said it incorrectly on the air on yesterday's program or not. I think I did, but I didn't have time to go back and check. But I know that I mentioned it incorrectly in my posting of yesterday's broadcast at bradblog.com last night. We were discussing Maryland's former Republican governor and now it's U.S. Senate candidate Larry Hogan on yesterday's program during my interview with investigative journalist Helen Santoro of The Lever, as she has been digging into the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapse at the Port of Baltimore ever since it occurred about 2 weeks ago. Then, we discussed then-Governor Larry Hogan, she had detailed how he had been repeatedly warned by safety experts over many years as governor about the dangers of allowing these larger and larger mega ships to come into the port of Baltimore, as he was encouraging, and that a mishap could result in the catastrophic collapse of the Key Bridge, which in fact tragically came to pass 2 weeks ago. Killed six bridge workers and shut down all the traffic in and out of one of the East Coast's largest ports ever since. Well, we discussed whether Hogan would actually face any accountability for that fact, that he had ignored all of these safety warnings about what became eventually a deadly tragedy. Whether he would face any accountability in his U.S. Senate race this fall, as I described it, against Maryland's Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen. In fact, and here's the correction, the Republican Hogan is not running against the incumbent senator, Democratic Senator Van Hollen. Rather, he's running for an open seat that's being vacated by the retiring Democratic Senator Ben Cardin.
Which underscores the importance of the 2024 election for control of the Senate, because it's a very narrow margin that Democrats have now, and there are many more Democratic seats up for grabs, especially this open seat in Maryland that could tip the balance of the Senate toward Republicans, and then all bets are off on your rights and freedoms.
Now we don't know yet who exactly Hogan will be running against on the Democratic side, by the way, to fill that vacant seat. There are currently about 10 Democrats running for the nomination in the state's May 14th primary elections. In fact, we don't even know for certain that Hogan will win the GOP nomination, as he's in a primary race with about six other Republicans. But he is far and away the polling front runner. He's almost certain to win on the Republican side, but he will not be running against Maryland's incumbent U.S. Senator Chris Van Hollen. As I had wrongly reported, but rather a different Democrat. My apologies for that error. Chalk it up to a brain fart on my part, though it is one I certainly regret. Hey, speaking of this November's elections, from the Every Vote Counts file, hat tip to the Daily Coast elections team for catching this one. As you know, California held its primary elections for president and members of Congress and the Senate, etc., back on Super Tuesday, on March 5, about a month ago. As you may also know, California takes its time counting votes to make sure that they get it right, to make sure that all of their mail-in ballots are properly authenticated, and to allow for incoming mail-in ballots sent by Election Day, which may not arrive until several days after the election, to be included in the final results. As you also may or may not know, several years ago out here in California, we switched from a traditional primary election where each party holds its own primary races and then the winners of each one challenge each other for the seat come November. We changed from that to a top two system where all candidates from all parties run together in the primary, and the two top vote getters in that primary, regardless of party, go on to compete for the seat in the fall. That, of course, means that in some cases you may see Republicans running against Republicans for a seat in November, or a Democrat running against another Democrat. This doesn't apply, by the way, to the presidential race out here, but that's how we now do it for primaries for House and Senate seats, for good or ill. Well, the results from the March 5th elections are now finalized in California. They must be certified, I think it's about 30 days after the election. And after tallying tens of thousands of votes in the U.S. House race for the soon-to-be-vacant U.S. House seat this year in California's 16th congressional district, it looks like we will be having a first-of-its-kind three-way race for that seat. As Daily Coast reports, California will host its first ever three-way House race of the top two era this fall, after final tallies showed two candidates finishing in an astonishing tie for second place. While media outlets declared former San Jose Mayor Sam Liccardo the first place finisher a week after the March 5 primary for California's open 16th district, Assemblyman Evan Lowe and Santa Clara County Supervisor Joe Smithian traded leads as small as a single vote over the ensuing month. But after county officials certified the returns late last week, both Lowe and Smithian wound up with exactly 30,249 votes each.
Wow. What are the odds? But like you said, it does underscore if just one more person had shown up to vote for either one of those people, this would not be happening.
Now, Daily Kos, a progressive outlet, notes that California does not conduct automatic recounts, but instead requires candidates to request them if they want them, but they also have to pay for them. Neither Simitian nor Lowe have the incentive to ask for such a recount, lest they fall behind, according to Kos. And given the expense, which would be likely several hundred thousand dollars, the front runner, Liccardo, also has little reason to want a recount either. The end result is a remarkable turn of events that upends the pattern that California voters have grown used to ever since they approved the creation of a top two primary back in 2010. Three candidates will now be vying for the seat, and in this case, they are all Democrats in the district that's just south of San Francisco. It's a heavily Democratic district. President Joe Biden carried it by a 75 to 22 margin in 2020. So it's definitely going to a Democrat. We just don't know which one. Democratic Congresswoman Anna Eshoo last faced a Republican opponent for that seat way back in 2018. But since she's retiring, the race to succeed her is now wide open. And nobody knows which of the three is actually going to win. Liccardo, who led the polls, he finished with just over 21%, while the second and third place finishers, Lowe and Simitian, each garnered exactly 16.6% each. So really, as Daily Kos argues, it's anyone's ball game in this unique race, underscoring, yes, once again, the importance of elections, all elections, because one single vote really can make a difference. Just ask Evan Lowe or Joe Simitian, if I'm saying his name right. For the record, though this is the first time that something like this has happened in a high-profile race since the Golden State began our top two primary system, for the first time back in 2012, it has actually happened before in circumstances that were somewhat less striking and much lower stakes. Back in 2016, Democrat Autumn Burke was unopposed when she sought re-election to the state assembly in a very blue district in L.A. She captured 99.9% of the vote in the primary. However, a pair of write-in candidates that year, a Republican and a Libertarian, each got 32 votes exactly. That sent all three contenders to a November face-off that year. There was not much drama in the fall. However, Burke crushed the second-place Republican in a 77 to 17% landslide. The third-place Libertarian took just 6% of the vote. This time, however, the competition by these three different Democrats for the 16th District U.S. House seat is expected to be fierce. All three of the Democrats will run well-funded campaigns, and California will experience a race the likes of which it has never seen before. Yes, every vote matters. And speaking of elections, as we frequently do, I have been sort of loath to cover this in recent days because this pattern began to first emerge a couple of weeks ago, for a number of reasons, I haven't wanted to cover it. Among them, we don't do a lot of polling coverage on this program, especially this early in an election year, as we tend to sort of keep our eyes more on the track conditions that the candidates are running on rather than their horse race, especially since polling is often misleading, particularly this early in the year, and particularly in recent years, by the way. But as we have noted from time to time, how Donald Trump has been reportedly leading Joe Biden in a number of national polls, and even specifically in several swing state polls, and as that fact has freaked out a lot of people, it seems worth noting here that appears to be changing in recent weeks. Like I said, I didn't want to mention it at first when this pattern sort of began to emerge, because there's always a lot of noise in polling this early that doesn't ultimately end up telling us really much at all about the races that will occur in November. But while scaring the hell out of Democrats with reports of Trump leading Biden this year, it seems proper to note when those polling numbers have begun to show a very different pattern, as many, including myself, have expected that we would see after things settled in for Americans that, yes, this race is almost certainly going to be a race between the Republican candidate Donald Trump and the Democratic candidate President Joe Biden this year. A number of folks have been observing this change in recent polling, both a minor change and a noteworthy change, if that's possible. But now it seems more than just noise in the polling, but an actual pattern. A number of those folks who have been writing about it in recent days. So allow me to lean on Josh Marshall here, his coverage of this today, a Talking Points memo. He reports in his piece headlined, "Yep, the polls are shifting to Biden," that for months, President Biden has been between 2 and 4 points behind in the polls, basically since late summer. But over the course of March, that has reversed, and the average of recent polls puts him either tied or slightly ahead of Donald Trump. Josh cites a few examples at TIP where Biden is +3, Emerson +1, Morning Consult. Emerson has Trump at +1. Morning Consult has Biden at +2. Marist has Biden +2. YouGov has the race tied. Marquette has Biden up by 4. Quinnipiac has Biden up by 3 nationally. He also notes the outliers of the far-right polling outfits Rasmussen and Trafalgar, which show Trump at +8 and +3, respectively, while noting that, quote, "now only the garbage flood the zone type polls are showing any Trump lead." The only real exception, he notes, since mid-March is the Fox poll, which had Trump up by 5. He notes, notwithstanding the name, Fox is actually considered to be a quality poll, Fox News's poll. But for now, it is an outlier, and it is older than all the rest of the polls shown here. Josh notes some caveats, for example, that he is only looking at head-to-head polling, not including third-party candidates. He says that is the better point of apples-to-apples comparison, and it's also a better predictor, though the role of third-party candidates, he notes, is going to be critical to the outcome. He says the last time he covered this polling about a week or so ago, showing an increase for Biden, that more data would be needed before making too much of the changing pattern here, in order to have confidence that this was a real movement in the polls rather than just polling noise. He says, we have that now. He says, while noting, of course, they can move back, but a big majority of polls are now showing the same movement by Joe Biden. The biggest caveat, he adds, is that Biden probably needs to be a few points ahead, a few more points ahead in the popular vote to actually win in the Electoral College. Remember, Hillary Clinton won the national popular vote by about 3 million votes, but she still ended up losing to Trump in the Electoral College, which has sort of an institutional bias in favor of Republicans right now. Putting emerging swing states like Georgia and Arizona into the equation, writes Marshall, could change that or mitigate the gap between the popular and the Electoral College results, but we should definitely assume that's the case, that Biden needs to get a few more points on the board here before you can assume that his lead also means he could win in the Electoral College. And so if Biden is currently tied or maybe 1 or 2 points ahead, that's probably not quite enough to win. It needs to be a couple more points beyond that. But the salient point that Josh draws from all of this is that roughly a month into the general election proper, that would be following the State of the Union address and the effective end of the presidential primary process, the polls have shifted modestly, but now clearly in Biden's direction. He says, quote, I'm not actually even sure modestly still applies here. In our current politics with strong partisan lock-in, you're simply not going to get 10-point poll swings. So moving from 3 or 4 points in one direction to a point or two in the other, he says, is significant. But still, the numbers are just the numbers. He writes, what I take from this is not that Biden's necessarily going to win the election or that it's smooth sailing from here on out. It's that Biden has a lot of strengths and Trump has a lot of liabilities that weren't going to be apparent until you got into a proper general election context. More to the point, just a few weeks ago, we were in this frenzy where a ton of the supposedly shrewdest political observers were saying it was the Democrats' race to lose, but that they were insisting on running a historically weak candidate in Joe Biden, and the only hope was to ditch the incumbent president and replace him in a Thunderdome convention with some governor who'd never run a national election before. He says the whole Biden is doomed narrative was bogus all along, and with a little perspective and putting a brown paper bag over your head to short-circuit hyperventilating, that should have been clear to anyone with any experience with national campaigns. Polls in early April, he reiterates, don't mean that much, but they mean more than polls in January and in February. The shift here points to Biden's underlying strength, but much more the fluidity of public opinion itself when the general election is only now getting started. So if you're worried about the presidential race, he says, good, stay worried.
Yes.
It's going to be tight. The stakes are enormous. But also, get some kick in your step. He advises the Trump lead into which everyone was pouring their worst fears appears to be slipping away. Biden's in this race, and there's reason to be optimistic about his chances, writes Josh. There will be tons of dirty tricks, fake news stories, foreign influence, and more. And he's absolutely right about that. But there is reason, at least a little, I think, to be optimistic. And again, I wanted to cover this because there was so much time being spent on what a disaster Joe Biden is. He can't possibly win. Well, now that we're looking more at a head-to-head race, at least in these polling numbers, that doesn't quite look to be the case.
No, it doesn't. I think it helps a lot that the media has finally backed off their obsession with, oh my God, Biden is old, as if it's some kind of new thing that we didn't know about, and pretending that Trump is not also old. And also the media focused on finally reporting the economy as it is, which is booming.
Hey, speaking of dirty tricks, we've got some accountability in court for some right-wing dirty tricksters from past elections today in several different cases. All of them, of course, were dirty tricks attempting to help Donald Trump's candidacy, because that's how these people roll. Far-right operatives Jacob Wohl and Jack Berkman have now agreed to pay New York Attorney General Letitia James's office up to $1.2 million for a robocall campaign that they orchestrated to suppress the black vote ahead of the 2020 election. You may remember this phony call from these two dopes back in 2020, in which someone identifies themselves as Tamika Taylor of Project 1599, warning black voters against voting at all, especially by mail, lest the voter face potential arrest after, quote, giving your private information to the man.
Hi, this is Tamika Taylor from Project 1599, a civil rights organization founded by Jack Berkman and Jacob Wohl. Mail-in voting sounds great, but did you know that if you vote by mail, your personal information will be part of a public database that will be used by police departments to track down old warrants and be used by credit card companies to collect outstanding debt? The CDC is even pushing to use records for mail-in voting to track people for mandatory vaccines. Don't be finessed into giving your private information to the man. Stay safe and beware of vote by mail.
So stay safe, stay home safe, and be aware of vote by mail. The CDC will use the information to track individuals for mandatory vaccines, to track old warrants, law enforcement, credit card companies, to collect debts. All of it, just utter nonsense. But that robocall went out to thousands of people in several states. New York Attorney General Tish James, who's been on a bit of a winning streak lately, said in a statement on Tuesday announcing the agreement, which still has to be signed off by a judge, but she said, quote, Wohl and Berkman orchestrated a depraved and disinformation-ridden campaign to intimidate black voters in an attempt to sway the election in favor of their preferred candidate. Now they will pay up to $1.25 million for having done so. James filed suit in 2021 against the pair. They were known for smearing Donald Trump's political opponents with transparently ridiculous and false accusations. The suit against them in New York alleged that they were responsible for over 5,000 robocalls filled with misinformation about voting in New York back in August of 2020. Last year, U.S. District Judge Victor Marrero found Wohl and Berkman liable for having violated state civil rights law and the federal Ku Klux Klan Act with the calls, saying the conduct was, quote, racially motivated and that, quote, the robocall sought to deter eligible black voters from exercising their right to vote, subjecting them to discrimination in their civil rights. Both of these clowns, Wohl and Berkman, have previously been penalized for these calls, which they put out in other states as well, because they're stupid. And it includes, by the way, their names at the top.
Yeah, that
Project
made no
59,
sense.
An organization by Jacob Wohl and Jack Berkman. Man, these are the dumbest dirty tricksters in the nation. And that's saying quite a bit. Anyway, they have both been penalized. The FCC hit them with a $5.1 million fine last year. They pleaded guilty to related charges in Ohio in 2022. They were sentenced to 2 years of probation and 500 hours of registering voters in that case. But there's still more accountability today for more of Donald Trump's right-wing dirty tricksters. Federal judge in Manhattan on Tuesday sentenced a Florida woman to 1 month behind bars for her role in a brazen scheme to steal the diary of President Biden's daughter and to sell it to a right-wing group in the hope of disrupting the 2020 election, according to the New York Times. Now, let me just pause for a moment to congratulate the New York Times here for describing right-wing dirty trickster and huckster James O'Keefe's now nearly defunct Dirty Tricks organization, Project Veritas, as a, yes, right-wing group versus a conservative group versus the even worse conservative journalist organization or something, as they routinely used to do when it came to O'Keefe's sleazy operation. And by the way, I got an alert about this from AP on my iPhone. Yes, describing the conservative group, Project Veritas.
AP.
Anyway, the conduct of the woman in question here, her name is Amy Harris, was, quote, despicable and consequently very serious, said Judge Laura Taylor Swain of the Federal District Court for the Southern District of New York before handing down this punishment. And boy, if you're looking for accountability, it seems New York is the place to go these days. That is likely very bad news for Trump, but we'll get to him in a bit. The 41-year-old Amy Harris, according to the Times, tested the patience of prosecutors and the judge overseeing the case. She missed repeated sentencing dates, and she jeopardized what otherwise appeared to be a likely path to probation. So what did she do? In August of 2022, she pleaded guilty to conspiring to transport the stolen diary of Joe Biden's daughter to New York, where she met with O'Keefe and other employees of the right-wing group Project Veritas. She sold it to them for $40,000 just weeks before the 2020 election. Yes, O'Keefe was willing to pay $40,000 for a stolen diary of a child of a presidential candidate. In a statement provided to the court, Ashley Biden, the daughter, described what happened to her as, quote, one of the most heinous forms of bullying. The judge also sentenced Harris to 3 years probation, along with that month in jail and along with 3 months of home confinement, and ordered her to pay back the money that she earned from the sale of the stolen diary. Hopefully she'll pay it back to the court, not to O'Keefe. But the article here doesn't actually say. Initially, federal prosecutors had recommended Harris face up to 6 months of home confinement and 3 years of supervised release, while her lawyers had requested probation only, but her sentencing was pushed back repeatedly, a dozen times, in part because Harris kept claiming that she had child care issues or that she was sick. She even called into the court one time from the emergency room. Exasperated prosecutors asked the judge this month to impose a sentence of 4 to 10 months in prison after saying that Harris had repeatedly and consistently engaged in tactics to improperly delay this proceeding. The judge finally threatened to have her arrested and brought to New York by U.S. Marshals if she didn't comply with the court's order and travel to New York for her sentencing. Anyway, she claimed that the diary that she stole had been abandoned and discarded at a friend's house where Ashley Biden had been staying. But prosecutors said that in August 21, in fact, she stole the diary, which Biden's daughter had left at the house to store along with other personal items. Harris then enlisted the help of a friend, a guy by the name of Robert Kurlender, to sell the diary. Eventually, the pair found a buyer in O'Keefe's Project Veritas. The two later returned to the house at one point, taking other items belonging to the president's daughter in order to confirm that she was, in fact, the diary's author. Because, you know, James O'Keefe is such a serious journalist. He wants to make sure that it's a legitimate piece of stolen property before he pays thousands of dollars for it. Kurlender, for his part, also pleaded guilty, but he has cooperated with the Justice Department into the theft. He's scheduled to be sentenced later this year. On Friday, prosecutors asked for a six-month delay in that sentencing. I'll explain that in a moment. But as part of its investigation, the FBI searched the homes of three former employees of Project Veritas, including its founder, O'Keefe. So far, none of them have been charged in this case. Now, remember, O'Keefe was pushed out of Project Veritas after employees denounced his management and spending, which, frankly, is putting it nicely by the New York Times here. In fact, those employees accused him of abuse of other employees and stealing millions of dollars from the group for personal luxuries. Hannah Giles, who succeeded him as chief executive, laid off employees when she was brought in, but she abruptly quit in December, writing on social media that she had, quote, stepped into an unsalvageable mess, one wrought with strong evidence of past illegality and past financial improprieties. I suspect that part of that past illegalities was this stolen diary issue. In December, a federal judge ruled the prosecutors could review hundreds of documents related to the theft of the diary by Project Veritas, which claimed that the materials were protected under the First Amendment and that, quote, disclosure to the government would violate their constitutional rights, constituting irreparable harm. The status of that investigation remains unclear at this point, but the fact that Kurlender delayed sentencing until October at the request of prosecutors suggests, at least to the New York Times here, that prosecutors have not yet ended their pursuit of Mr. O'Keefe.
I just want to note that it took almost 4 years to get to this final conviction.
Yep. Well, justice takes a while, but... Yep. Keep hope alive when it comes to O'Keefe and being charged here. Donald Trump may be trying also to keep hope alive in advance of his first of four criminal trials, set to begin with jury selection in New York on Monday, April 15. But That ain't the only problem he's still facing in New York, with Attorney General Tish James reportedly still hot on his trail. Those stories are all still ahead, along with the latest Green News Report with Desi Doyen. I'm Brad Friedman. You are listening to The Bradcast.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. That's sort of the only music we could find that kind of suggests 1864. That would be the Arizona law that bans nearly all abortions, adopted in 1864, but Arizona's high court on Tuesday said that, they may be able to enforce that law after all this year, since the overturning of Roe v. Wade, and that, well, that's just another reason why there was a very close race for attorney general this year. The Democrat
in Arizona,
In Arizona, the Democrat ended up winning it, which means she is unlikely to enforce this 1864 law. But that's another reminder how elections do matter.
Yeah, she won by just hundreds of votes.
That music also, it was used in the movie The Sting.
Yes.
And when we're dealing with the con man Donald Trump, it also seems appropriate for that reason. It is shaping up to be another very bad week for the former president in the courts this week, specifically in New York, which of course means it's a good week for Americans, for America, for democracy, and for the world, frankly. A New York appeals court judge on Tuesday denied Donald Trump's bid to halt his hush money trial while he appeals a gag order against him, a ruling that came less than 24 hours after another judge rejected the former president's separate request to delay his impending criminal trial on completely different grounds. He's basically throwing everything against the wall that he can, hoping something sticks. And so far, over the past 24 to 48 hours, nothing has. And in this case, the courts in New York have been moving quite quickly to say nope. Tuesday's ruling came roughly 1 hour after Trump attorney Emile Bove argued that his client is entitled to a stay of the proceedings while he challenges the, quote, unconstitutional partial gag order that Judge Juan Merchan had handed down against Trump last month and then expanded days later, barring him from attacking witnesses and jurors and the family members of either the judge or the Manhattan district attorney, Alvin Bragg, though both the judge, Judge Merchan and Bragg himself, they're actually still fair game for Donald Trump to attack all he likes, apparently, on social media and so forth. The gag order was expanded by the judge after Trump had attacked the judge's daughter via his couldn't find one of her diaries to steal and post online. Anyway, Trump attacked the judge's daughter on his social media site. He included her name and her photograph, but somehow, barring Trump from attacking family members of the judge and the prosecutor and the witnesses and the jurors, that is somehow unconstitutional, according to Trump's attorneys. It is not unconstitutional. Trump's attorneys contend the gag order means that his client can't comment on publicly filed motions. It doesn't mean that at all, and that it violates the former president's Sixth and First Amendment rights, which it also does not violate. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office, which brought the case against Trump, told the judge that there is no basis for a stay in the matter and that the attorney Bove was misrepresenting the gag order. This is not a political debate, prosecutor said. These are threats against staff that have led to a barrage of attacks that have led to the NYPD becoming involved. Judge Cynthia Kern's order on Tuesday allows Trump's attorneys to go ahead and make their case for a stay to a full panel of the appellate division judges if he wishes. His court filings for that request are due Monday morning, the same time, by the way, that jury selection is scheduled to begin in the case in New York. In this case, this is the New York criminal case where Trump is charged with 34 felony counts of falsifying business records related to hush money payments to an adult film star in the closing days of the 2016 election in order to help him cheat to win that election. He has pleaded not guilty to all 34 felony counts. And we wish him luck in a fair trial that begins on Monday, the first criminal trial ever in the nation's history for a U.S. president. In the fair trial that he already received in the massive civil fraud case against him, him and his company and its top executives, including his two eldest sons. Well, that has taken a fascinating turn since late last week, when I know a lot of folks were actually disappointed last week that Trump seemed to be able to pull a rabbit out of the hat, or in this case, a bond out of thin air to cover the $175 million that the court has required him to file in a bond after lowering it from $454 million, which he still owes, because his, as his attorneys told the court, nobody would give him a bond for that much money, for $454 million. And he needs to file that bond while appealing his case in order to prevent Attorney General Tish James from seizing his property to pay for the $464 million that he still owes in total. So he came up with this $175 million bond, and that disappointed people. But again, if you were disappointed about that, once again, keep hope alive. As Jose Pagliari reports at the Daily Beast, the little-known insurance company that rescued Donald Trump by providing a last-minute $175 million bank fraud bond isn't just unlicensed in New York. It hasn't even been vetted by a voluntary state entity that would verify that it meets minimum eligibility standards to prove financial stability. There is a whole lot of trouble with this bond. Pagliari writes, perhaps even more troubling, the legal document from the Knight Specialty Insurance Company does not actually promise that it will pay the money at all if the former president loses his $464 million bank fraud case on appeal. Instead, it says that Trump will pay, negating the whole point of an insurance company guarantee that, according to three legal and bond experts who reviewed the contract for the Daily Beast. Quote, this is not common. The only reason this would be done is to limit the liability to the surety, which is, that's Knight Specialty Insurance in this case. That, according to Alex Hanley, an expert in how companies appeal enormous judgments. These two points validate the New York Attorney General's concern that Trump is trying to avoid a financial punishment that could be catastrophic to his riches and to his reputation. There are many questions here, and that short piece of paper gives very little comfort, said Maria Vullo, who was formerly New York's top financial regulator. Another former regulator, who's intimately familiar with industry norms, said, quote, I believe this paper isn't worth much and there are more shenanigans behind it. After a three-month trial ended with a state judge concluding that Trump committed bank fraud for a decade by lying about his wealth and his property values, the real estate tycoon and his top executives were ordered to pay $464 million, which is a massive sum, and one that increases every single day with interest to the tune of about $100,000 each day that he doesn't pay it off in full, whether he has a bond on file or he's appealing the case or not. but unable to find, or claiming he was unable to find, a large and trusted surety company to provide the $500 million bond that would legally halt Letitia James from seizing his properties, Trump convinced an appellate court to lower that sum to $175 million. He then opted for this insurance company from out here in California, tied to a guy by the name of Don Hankey Jr., apparently a billionaire MAGA supporter who has built a nasty reputation by dealing in subprime auto loans that have resulted in numerous complaints and penalties for predatory business practices. For example, illegally repossessing the cars of American soldiers. What's more, according to the Daily Beast, in addition to not being licensed in New York, the firm's financial statements show that it doesn't have the surplus that is required to meet the capital requirements for posting this bond in the first place. They must have at least 10 times the amount of surplus cash, 10 times the amount of the highest payout that they might eventually have to pay out. Just like federal regulators require financial institutions to have sufficient reserves in case of a bank run, New York law limits how much money state-regulated surety companies can post on one single bond to just 10% of the firm's total capital and surplus. But it appears that this company does not have 10 times $175 million. In fact, court filings by the company last week showed that the Knight Specialty has only $138 million in surplus. That vastly fails to meet the New York requirement because the Trump bond alone makes up 127% of the company's reserve. So basically, they do not meet a number of requirements to file this bond, according to all of these experts. In subsequent court filings, the AG's office questioned whether Knight Specialty was even good for the money. The law enforcement agency said it, quote, takes exception to the sufficiency of the surety, noting that Knight Specialty is trying to operate without a certificate of qualification to do business in New York. The company's president, Amit Shah, defended the firm's ability to strike this deal, told CBS that Knight, quote, is not a New York domestic insurer, and New York surplus lines insurance laws do not regulate the solvency of non-New York excess lines insurers. And yet, the company must be licensed in New York, at least within 45 days, in order to issue the bond in the first place. So there are a few problems here.
There's some shenanigans going on that might really allow Trump to avoid paying for his crime and his crimes and stiff taxpayers.
The New York laws don't apply to them because they're not in New York, and yet the law in New York says you have to be licensed in New York. Good luck with that. In fact, as the Daily Beast notes, a strict reading of bond number 350588 shows that Knight Specialty is not actually technically on the hook for paying out the $175 million if higher courts ultimately agree that Trump lost to the AG here. So buried in the typical legalese of the contract is the phrase, quote, Knight Specialty Insurance Company does hereby undertake that if the judgment is dismissed, Donald J. Trump shall pay the sum directed. Defeating the whole purpose of a guaranteed bond, where the company issuing it is supposed to be guaranteeing that they will pay if the insured person doesn't. In other words, if Trump loses the case, Trump will pay, according to this so-called bond, but that is no different than Trump's obligation before the bond was issued. Lots of problems with this bond.
Yeah.
And by the way, this is the second big-figure bond in recent weeks from Trump, making the earlier bond apt for comparison, as the Daily Beast does. In that other case, Trump is appealing an $83 million federal jury verdict for defaming journalist E. Jean Carroll by denying that he raped her. He managed, in that case, to score a deal with a subsidiary of the insurance giant Chubb that would force it to pay $92 million if Trump can't cough up the money in the event that he loses his appeal. Unlike the bank fraud bond, the Carroll bond agreement specifically states, quote, such payment shall be made by the surety to the obligee if Trump fails to pay. But that's not what the one on this $175 million says. And as if that's not enough, there's another gem they note buried in this contract that has industry experts and lawyers scratching their heads. The standard practice would be to promise that the loser would pay the judgment, quote, plus interests and costs. But Trump's bank fraud bond does not list that either. Instead, it says the liability of this bond shall not exceed the sum of $175 million. Which just ain't the case. In response to Tish James' questioning of the validity of the bond, the court has scheduled a hearing for April 22 on this matter. So those who were hoping to see James start taking Trump's property or properties from him even before his appeal is heard later this year, well, again, as I keep saying, keep hope alive. Green News Report is next. I'm Brad, and of course, this is the Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad. My thanks to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate to help Desi Doyen and I stay on your public airwaves. You're the only one that keeps us here. Thank you. All right, running late, so let's get to it. Our latest Green News Report.
Take a look at the ocean heat content. It is normal for July right now, something we've never seen before.
Buckle up. It's going to be a hyperactive hurricane season. New report finds half of the Colorado River's water is used to grow feed for cattle. Plus,
the water system in California was designed for a world that no longer exists.
Good news for California's mountain snowpack, for now.
All of that good news and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
And the first day, I promise you, I will sign where the electric vehicle mandate is gone.
Cool. There is no electric vehicle mandate. But you go ahead and cancel it, hero. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, though Donald Trump promises to cancel the electric vehicle mandate, which doesn't exist, perhaps there should be such a mandate, given your lead story today.
Yes, unfortunately, we start with not great news. Levels of the three most critical heat-trapping gases in the atmosphere reached new record highs again last year. According to NOAA, global concentrations of carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide climbed to new all-time highs. The researchers say the increases were relatively small, but, quote, represent a major change in the composition of the atmosphere even from just a decade ago, and show that humanity still has a lot of work to do to cut the greenhouse gases responsible for dangerous human-caused global warming.
We are going the wrong way.
In other news, buckle up. The hurricane season forecasters at Colorado State University predict that 2024 will see an extremely active Atlantic hurricane season. It's the highest number of hurricanes they have ever predicted. 23 named storms, 11 hurricanes, 5 likely to be Category 3 or higher.
Cool, because whenever they do that, they get it all wrong. So nothing to worry about.
It's based on two main factors. El Nino is shifting into a La Nina, which usually enhances Atlantic storm formation, and record warm ocean waters in the Atlantic, which provide heat energy to sustain big storms and, if they make landfall, can drive impacts far inland.
Uh-oh.
Meanwhile, a new report finds that just 57 companies, fossil fuel and cement producers, are responsible for 80% of global fossil fuel carbon dioxide emissions emitted since the Paris Agreement was signed in 2015.
Really?
The report from the UK's Influence Map found that fossil fuel companies, the world's biggest emitters and biggest drivers of climate change, have actually expanded production in the years since the Paris Agreement.
Of course they have.
In the U.S. West, states are grappling with shrinking Colorado River water levels caused by global warming and overuse by humans. Now a new study, the most complete accounting so far of how the river is used, pinpoints that about half of the river's water is being diverted to grow alfalfa, or hay, to feed cattle. That's three times more than all other human uses combined, all the cities and all the industries across seven states. The study comes as negotiations are underway between states, tribes, and the federal government to craft new long-term rules on managing the river. Good news in California. Thanks to recent storms, the state's mountain snowpack, upon which it relies for about a third of its water, is at 110% of average.
Really?
For the second year in a row, according to state water managers. Major reservoirs are also in good shape, likely ensuring that the state will not see a severe drought this summer. That's a welcome sign after two back-to-back historic droughts.
Yep.
At the annual snowpack survey in the Sierra Nevada mountains, California Governor Gavin Newsom warned Californians, don't get used to it, underscoring the urgency of ongoing planning and construction of new water infrastructure to prepare for the next severe drought and the impacts of climate change.
These extremes are becoming the new reality, and that new reality requires a new approach and a new sophistication in terms of the way we address and manage our water system. It's just the new reality and the new normal. The world's changed, and we need to change and adapt with it.
And finally, also in California, Disneyland's smelly, polluting bumper cars are getting an upgrade. Autopia, part of Walt Disney's Tomorrowland, will join the 21st century. The LA Times reports park officials plan to electrify the attraction, converting the bumper cars away from gas engines to electric engines over the next few years, saving money on fuel costs and cleaning up the air.
The next few years? How long is it going to take? For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.brandblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. Wow. That is a happy ending,
yes,
for a change to the Green News Report.
A bit.
Thank you very much, Desi Doyen. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com, the happiest place on earth. That is made possible, by the way, by those of you kind enough to stop by bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. Drop me an email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, you will find me at The Brad Blog. We will see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.